You're listening to Beyond Bourbon Street, an insider's guide to New Orleans. Beyond Bourbon Street is the podcast where we explore the food, music, culture, places, and people that make New Orleans unique. Whether you are planning a trip, living in New Orleans, or simply wanting a taste of the Crescent City from wherever you are, you've come to the right place. And now, your host, Mark Bologna.
Hey y'all, this is Mark. Welcome to episode 154. Today's episode's a Q&A show with questions from listeners like you. The last show was all about the Mardi Gras Indians. If you missed it, go back and give it a listen. I think you'll enjoy it. Before we jump in, let me talk about the people that make the show possible. First off, support comes from the Historic New Orleans Collection, the city's premier history museum, located at 520 Royal Street in the heart of the French Quarter. There, you'll get to explore three centuries of great New Orleans stories in some of our most historic spaces, and admission is free. Don't miss the immersive film about the history of the French Quarter at night or any of the museum's changing exhibitions in the brand new Tricentennial Wing. Go to hnoc.org/visit to plan your trip. Today's episode is also sponsored by our Patreon supporters. If you love the podcast, the Facebook group, and the work I'm doing, please consider becoming a monthly supporter. Find out more at patreon.com/beyondbourbonst. We have plenty of perks at all levels, and if you join at the $10 level or higher, we'll mention you on an upcoming episode. Finally, did you know that I have a book coming out? The Beyond Bourbon Street Travel Guide to New Orleans. You can pre-order a copy at Amazon, Barnes & Noble, or bookshop.org, and we'll put links to all those in the show notes. Now, let's get into the listener questions. As always, we start off with questions from our Patreon supporters, so we'll start there. Let me pull them up. First up, the first question comes from Chris Marshall, who asks, what was your favorite carnival memory or moment this year? You know, I think it was the first weekend and just getting out to parades and a sense of normalcy. We had a lot of apprehension about what it was going to be like, you know, a little concern about would it be a super spreader event. Mardi Gras is a time where you're sharing food and hugging and around a lot of people. And it was just really normal. You know, it was nice to be out on that first Saturday, enjoying parades, seeing friends that we see pretty much only at Mardi Gras, and just a sense of normalcy. So for me, that was really, we had a lot of good memories this year. We'll get into some of them as we get through some of the other questions. But for me, Chris, that was it. That first moment, that first couple of parades on that Saturday, and just being back out in the throes of Mardi Gras. Cliff Hochberg writes, we'll be in New Orleans June 19th through 25th. I'll be attending jazz camp during the day. Hey, that's cool. And my wife will be touring around the city during the day. So many things to see that you've discussed over the years for her during the days. Since COVID, things have changed. So in your opinion, what would be the absolute must-dos to maximize the best daytime experience? So Cliff, good question. I would refer you to a couple of previous podcasts. Episode 39 was the top 10 things to do on your first visit. Episode 82 was free or nearly free things to do. I think it was 52 free or nearly free things to do. And 105 was top things to do in New Orleans right now. And I look back through those notes, and I think they all still hold up really well. You can see from 39 to 105, that spans a couple years. I think that if you listen to those, you'll find plenty of things. I would say that the only difference right now with COVID, you know, a couple things have closed. The Backstreet Cultural Museum is in the process of moving, so it's closed. The House of Dance and Feathers is closed. Those are two things that were really high on my list. But things like riding the streetcar, touring the Garden District. We have a sponsor, Katrina Horning. New Orleans Architecture Tours does a great job. That's a fun thing to do. They have a couple different tours, including one in the Marigny now. Getting out on the streetcars, experiencing the city, walking around Magazine Street, City Park, taking in a cemetery. I think, and those are all types of things that I covered in those three episodes. I think they all still hold true. The thing that's a little different with COVID now is that the hours are adjusted in a lot of places, particularly restaurants. So if you want to go somewhere, I highly recommend that you check or call ahead to make sure that they're open. I don't know if this is true across the country, but it's certainly true here with labor shortages. Restaurants just have shorter hours. You know, they have fewer days. Their hours on the days they're open aren't as long. They seem to change kind of frequently. So those are things I would pay attention to. But check out those three episodes, and I'll put links in the show notes to those. I think they still really hold up well. Ross Wiley asks, "Hey Mark, can you talk about the Mid-City area? We've spent many wonderful nights at Rock and Bowl and had the opportunity to spend most of the evening with John Blanchard last trip there." And then he says, "I guess Rock and Bowl technically is outside of Mid-City." So that's right. The original Rock and Bowl was inside the confines of Mid-City, and the newer post-Katrina Rock and Bowl is technically in the Fontainebleau Carrollton area, but by a couple blocks. So Mid-City, talking neighborhoods and boundaries in New Orleans, is always somewhat controversial, but from my point of view, Mid-City is bounded by I-10, Broad Street, Orleans Avenue, and City Park Avenue. So it includes parts of Bayou St. John and the Lafitte Greenway, which is, Bayou St. John is great for walking and canoeing and kayaking. The Lafitte Greenway is perfect if you wanted to rent a bike and ride. You can ride from essentially the back end of the French Quarter into Mid-City. It's really nice. It's scenic. It's not too long. Mid-City technically is, I guess, adjacent to City Park, but I would include City Park in Mid-City. I guess some people might argue it's Lakeview, but you certainly have City Park right there. And so, you know, you have all the things that we've talked about on past episodes in City Park to do, whether it's the New Orleans Museum of Art, or there are things for kids to do there. There's beignets. There's the oldest grove of oak trees in the city there. I also think in terms of architecture, you have some larger houses on Canal Street. You also have a nice mix of bungalows, some small and some large, along Bayou St. John and along the area right off City Park Avenue, as well as Carrollton Avenue. To get to Mid-City from downtown, you would take the Red Streetcar and take the Carrollton Extension, the one that runs to City Park. Also in that area, I think I've mentioned before, there's some really great places to eat. There's Venetia's for kind of classic old school New Orleans Italian, Sicilian Italian food. Good pizza there as well. There's Angelo Bucata's, which has been in existence for over 100 years. Great place for Italian desserts, for cannoli and spumoni. You have Revel, which is a terrific cocktail bar in that area, run by one of the foremost authorities on cocktails. Has literally written the book on cocktails. So that's a really great place if you're into craft cocktails. Again, you have Mofo, which is a kind of Vietnamese New Orleans fusion restaurant. You have Ike's Snowballs right across from Delgado. So that's right on the edge of, again, I guess you would still consider it Mid-City. You also have a Katrina Memorial, Hurricane Katrina. If you took the Canal Street streetcar to where it ran out, not the extension that went into City Park. There's a whole bunch of cemeteries there that are worth exploring. And again, that's right on the edge of Mid-City as well. But there's a Katrina Memorial that, if you could see a drone shot from above, it's in the shape of the hurricane symbol that you would see on a map. But it's a memorial to the lives lost there, and that's worth checking out as well. So there's a lot to do in Mid-City. You also have, right along Bayou St. John, you have Parkway Bakery, which is a great po' boy shop. You have Bayou Beer Garden and Bayou Wine Garden. We're in crawfish season now. They have great crawfish there, pop-up crawfish. So that's a great thing to do. So you got a good mix of architecture. You have things to walk and see and do and kind of outdoor activities. You have some really good food choices. And again, it's accessible by the streetcar. So it's a really cool area. It's a neighborhood, which is also neat to get away from, say, Bourbon Street, right? And get into a neighborhood and just see the architecture and wander around. It's a great place to wander around and look at architecture. So there's some ideas for you. Next up is James Cullen. When is the official release date of the Beyond Bourbon Street book? who are you most excited to see at Jazz Fest, and when will James Cullen be back on the show? So I do have a book, the Beyond Bourbon Street Travel Guide. It's been in the works for a couple of years now with some delays because of COVID. It is tentatively scheduled to be released on May 1st. You can pre-order the book now. I mentioned at the top of the show at Amazon, at Barnes & Noble, and also at bookshop.org, which is sort of a collaborative of indie bookshops. And I'll put links to that in the show notes. So it's supposed to come out May 1st. One of the problems, like everything in this world right now, is supply chain issues. So the publisher can't guarantee me that they'll be ready. They're supposed to be in the warehouse. The book's in April. The book launch is supposed to be May 1st, but it's been delayed several times because of supply chain issues. So hopefully it will get there. If you pre-order, then you'll get the book as soon as it's in the warehouses at those respective businesses. So if you're interested, that's the number one thing you can do to help me, is to pre-order the book and then write a review when it comes in. But that's about when it's coming. I'm going to jump to his third question. When will James be back on the show? James did a lot of the photography work in the book. And so he and I are going to do a kind of behind the scenes making of the book episode coming up in the next couple episodes. And so we'll get James back on for that. And then who am I most excited to see at Jazz Fest? You know, what I'm most excited for is to have Jazz Fest. I think of the big acts, I'm a big Foo Fighters fan. I really like Dave Grohl. I enjoyed Jimmy Buffett at Jazz Fest. Longtime listeners know I want to get Jimmy Buffett on the show and have him talk not about his career, but about his love of New Orleans. He started his career as a street busker here in New Orleans in the French Quarter, and I would so love to get him on the show and talk to him about that. So as always, whenever this comes up, I'll mention it here. If any of you have a connection to Jimmy Buffett, I would love to get connected with him and have the opportunity to interview him on the podcast. But Jimmy Buffett is just fun, and Jazz Fest is about fun. So the Foo Fighters and Jimmy Buffett are the big ones. I'm really looking forward to seeing Randy Newman. I think Randy Newman is incredibly underrated. His shows at Jazz Fest are well attended but never packed. He is from Louisiana, I believe. He's written several songs about Louisiana. He's a thoughtful songwriter. I just am always moved listening to him at Jazz Fest. And then the other is not a particular act, but I get just a replenishment of my soul by going to the Faye Dodo stage and listening to whomever appears. I think one of the best parts of Jazz Fest is wandering around and not being wed to a schedule. And consistently, I can go to the Faye Dodo stage and the gospel tent, but the Faye Dodo is my favorite, and just sit there and take in whoever shows up on stage and know that I'm going to have a wonderful time, hear great music, I'm going to see people dancing, and it's going to be a good time. So for me, I think, again, Foo Fighters, Jimmy Buffett, Randy Newman, and the Faye Dodo stage. And yes, we'll get you on the show soon, James. Joe Grillo asks, I'll be coming down for French Quarter Festival this year and was interested in visiting the Indian Museum. I believe it's in the 9th Ward and you have to make an appointment. I'll be staying in the Lower Garden District on Jackson. Can you recommend any great watering holes or restaurants within walking distance? So the Backstreet Cultural Museum is closed right now. They are moving to the African American Museum has offered to rent them space. So the Backstreet Cultural Museum was significantly damaged in Hurricane Ida. And they, at the same time, about a year ago, year and a half ago, Mr. Sylvester Francis, the founder of the museum, passed away. So they have been in a bit of turmoil. The African American Museum has offered to rent them space, and I believe they're going to take them up on it, but they haven't moved yet. They have been posting on Facebook and Instagram quite a bit. Their website is not up to date. So the answer, Joe, is when you are coming in town, I would check their Instagram and or their Facebook and see what the status is, because they may not be open or they may have gotten themselves reopened by then. If they're open, it is definitely worth a visit. In its old space, it was pretty small, but a pretty significant, probably the most significant display of Indian culture, second line culture, baby doll culture, a really well done small museum that really pays tribute to that part of our culture. So definitely worth doing. Let's see, what was your second question? You'll be staying in the Lower Garden District on Jackson Avenue. So watering holes and restaurants, depending on where you're at on Jackson Avenue, you're not far from Stein's Deli, which is a really great deli. That's a good spot for lunch. You're not far from Joey K's. There's Coquette down there. There is District Donuts for donuts and coffee in the morning. If you walk up to St. Charles, you are close to Avenue Pub, which is one of the best tap rooms in the country, much less in the city. There is, at the Pontchartrain Hotel, there is are two bars, Jack Rose and Tin Roof, both well worth checking out. So you're in a good spot to walk. Again, you want to walk to Magazine Street, kind of walk up and down there. You'll find several options. And then you want to walk up to St. Charles Avenue. Igor's is not far from, right off of Jackson and St. Charles. Again, Avenue Pub and the Pontchartrain Hotel. So you have several options within easy walking distance from where you are. As always, I would just pay attention at night. It's not a bad spot at all, but it is, you know, this is a big city, so you don't want to be walking late at night in some of those spots, but you'll be fine otherwise. Let's see, Mark Ristine, or Ristini, says, one of my favorite spots in New Orleans is Pirate's Alley. Can you tell me a little bit about the facts and the history and the legends? Whenever I visit this spot, I could just stay there and soak it up for hours. So I don't know a ton, and there's not a ton about it, but I will tell you, it was actually called Orleans Alley until the mid-1960s. One possible reason for it being called Pirate's Alley is that there was a Spanish dungeon behind the Cabildo, which is right next to Pirate's Alley. So that may have been a reason that it was called Pirates. It's unlikely that pirates hung out there. It's, you know, right next to a church, and it was next to a Spanish government building, so that doesn't quite make sense. In terms of hanging out there, it's a really great place to take photographs. We took our wedding photographs, actually, in Pirate's Alley. For whatever reason, when it's foggy, the fog seems to get trapped there in that alley. And so that leads to some really neat opportunities for photographs. I can totally see why you would want to spend time there and hang out. It's also one of those kind of spots in the French Quarter where you step into the alley and all of a sudden it's a little bit quieter. And I get overwhelmed in the French Quarter sometimes just with the noise and the stimulation. And so Exchange Alley, Pirates Alley are good places to just duck in for a moment and have a little bit of a respite from just the craziness of the French Quarter. So that's a little bit. I wish I could tell you more, but I actually did a little research on it, and there's just not a ton about it, amazingly enough, for as popular as it is and as photographed as it is. Let's see. David Kimberly, I know you've talked about coffee on a podcast. I have. But can you talk a bit about iconic New Orleans coffee and chicory and cafe au lait? Maybe a little bit about the history. So chicory is a root that's not that doesn't include caffeine or doesn't have caffeine. It's typically used in cafe au lait. And the history of it's a little murky. It seems that the French used it as a coffee substitute or a coffee additive at a time when it was hard to get coffee. It has a strong taste by itself. It's a little bitter, but combined with coffee, it kind of is a nice complement. And so it's one of those things that happened sort of out of hardship or necessity, but then it just stuck. Again, it is very often used in cafe au lait. So when you order a cafe au lait, particularly here in New Orleans anyway, what you're mostly going to get for the coffee part is coffee and chicory. In terms of, he also asked about Rose Nicode, I'm not sure I'm saying her name right, Café du Monde and Morning Call. So Café du Monde opened in 1862, and they are opened at least before COVID, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. The one exception, 364 days a year. The one exception is they close on Christmas Day. They also will occasionally close if there's a hurricane particularly close to town. Their hours have gotten a little bit interrupted with COVID, but for the most part, they are open all the time. And they first opened in 1862. Morning Call opened in 1870, so almost as old. They both had stands in the French Quarter. Today, of course, Morning Call only has a stand where Canal Street turns into Canal Boulevard, a relatively new location. Whereas Cafe Du Monde has a couple locations. They have one in the airport, they have the iconic one down in the French Quarter, and then they have one in City Park. Rose Nicot, and again, I'm probably butchering her name, but where she's significant is she's believed to be the first coffee vendor in New Orleans. Rose was a slave in the early 1800s, and she sold both coffee noir, so just black coffee, and café au lait to workers in the French Quarter. Since she was enslaved, most of her earnings went to her owner, but she was able to keep some of her earnings, and eventually she was able to purchase her freedom with the portion that she kept. Originally, Rose sold from a cart, but eventually she had an actual stand with seating for her customers, and she's believed to be the first coffee seller in the city of New Orleans. Again, it was the early 1800s, you know, and when I say she sold in the French Quarter, that essentially was the city of New Orleans then. Dan Timur, Mark, I hope all is well, and your Mardi Gras season was amazing. Can you shed some light on the enigmatic Lafcadio Hearn and his significance to the history and culture of New Orleans? So I have to say, usually the questions, I can answer them just off the top of my head, and I don't tend to look at them ahead of time. And this time I looked, and I'm glad I did, because these questions are pretty in the weeds, pretty challenging. So Lafcadio Hearn lived from 1850 to 1904. And he's one of these guys that is sort of mythologized in New Orleans from today's view. But the reality is he moved to New Orleans in 1877 from Cincinnati, where he was a newspaper reporter and a columnist. He only lived in New Orleans for 10 years. Now, during that time, he held a bunch of different positions at several newspapers. He eventually became an editor at The Item. And among other things, he produced woodcuts for the paper. He did them himself until it got to be too much work. But those woodcuts did two things. They greatly increased the circulation, and they also enabled the paper to become the first newspaper in the South to have cartoons. So that also increased circulation. I think one of the reasons he's kind of a mythological figure in New Orleans is that he wrote for national publications too, like Harper's. And he's the one that's credited with popularizing this idea that New Orleans was more or is more similar to Europe and to the Caribbean than to the rest of the country, to the rest of North America. It's interesting that he wasn't that popular in New Orleans. He was a bit of a gossip writer as well, a little bit of a man about town, but he wasn't particularly well known or a particularly big figure in New Orleans during his time. It's just sort of been in the years since. And one of the odd things about him is what he's best known for has nothing to do with New Orleans. He later went to Japan, took a Japanese name, and really was credited with introducing the West to a lot of the teachings and the writings, particularly of Japan. So, you know, it's interesting that, again, when I saw the name, it made me smile. He wrote a couple books while he was in New Orleans, one of which was a cookbook, a recipe book, that kind of documented the early restaurant history here in New Orleans. But he wasn't here that long, and he didn't have a huge impact, yet somehow, you know, in the years since, he's become this larger-than-life figure in New Orleans. People kind of wax nostalgic about his writing. And again, he did document life in New Orleans. And again, he was a little bit of a gossip, so kind of a source for who was doing what and the kind of glamorous of the day, right? He did sort of document that. So interesting question, Dan. Joe Sweeney. Mark, it was so great to see you on Mardi Gras Day. There are many great parades. It must be impossible to have a single favorite. Let me throw a few categories for favorites. Day parade, night parade, family parade, definitely not family parade. Best food, best energy. All right, so I'm going to answer these questions, Joe, based on parades we went to this year. And so that's a big caveat because there were a lot of changes this year. The routes were shortened. As a result, we didn't go to some of the parades we normally would go to. We didn't get to go to some of the areas we would normally go to. So I'm going to answer just based on only parades we went to this year. Day parade, Iris. Iris is an all-women's parade. I think it probably reaches the status of a super crew. It's on a Saturday morning, the Saturday before Mardi Gras. They throw a ton of stuff. Their kind of shtick is they throw decorated sunglasses. So, you know, you have Muses throws shoes, Zulu throws coconuts, Nyx throws purses, Iris decorates sunglasses. I think it's a beautiful parade. It's a big parade. It's very family friendly. As you know, Joe, I have 10-year-old twins. They catch a lot, which is important to 10-year-old twins. When I was a kid, Iris was a terrible parade. It wasn't that long. It felt like they threw one strand of beads at a time. It just wasn't a good parade. Now it's a terrific parade. My feeling on that is that with the rise of the female supercrews like Muses and formerly Nyx, I think that you had a demand, and when people couldn't get into some of those parades or decided they wanted to be in a parade but didn't want to be in a night parade, it really benefited Iris. And Iris is now just a really, really top five parade for me. Really well done. Lots of throws. Beautiful. I like that Saturday. It's a good day. They're followed by Tux, which is quite a different parade. Very irreverent. Lots of fun in its own way. But day parade, I would say Iris. Family parade, I would say the first weekend. And this is also a tip for people that are new to Mardi Gras. The first weekend is a terrific weekend. The parades maybe aren't as great as the second weekend, although they're good. But the crowds are a little bit lighter. Really good family experience. So for us, family parade, we went the first weekend. We went on Saturday. I'm going to draw a blank. Choctaw, Pontchartrain, and Ferret, I think. And Ferret is a parade that is trying to become a super crew. So they have kind of picked up some smaller. The crew of Nyx imploded last year and went from a super crew to a barely functioning crew because of some internal politics and bad decisions on the part of the captain. But several smaller crews formed out of it. And several of them, because they're not big enough yet or don't have permits to parade, have kind of joined into parades like Ferret. So Ferret had like a couple sub crews to it. But family parade, instead of a parade, I would say the first Saturday is just a terrific day to go out with kids, particularly young kids. Night parade, for me this year, it was Orpheus. Marie and I used to ride or have ridden in Orpheus, which is the Monday before Mardi Gras. This year, we had the opportunity to go to the Orpheuscapade. So that is the, not really ball, but the party in the convention center. So the parade rides into the convention center. It's a black tie, evening gown kind of event. I hadn't been to Orpheus in many years because it's the night before Mardi Gras, and we usually take that night off with the kids so we can get up early for Mardi Gras Day. I forgot just how beautiful that parade is. And it's a super crew, so it has some of the big, it has the Smoky Mary float, which is 8 or 9 units long. Pretty amazing to see. And it's just a pretty parade. Definitely not family parade, crew de vue. That's your parade if you want to see lots of lewd, lots of things, lots of paper mache body parts, but definitely a fun parade. Best energy, I think Muses. Muses is such a fun parade. The women in the parade are clearly having a good time. There's such a desire for the shoes. They're certainly the second most popular throw at Mardi Gras beyond the Zulu coconut. It's a nighttime parade, so it has that energy about it. I don't know how to answer the best food. Typically, Mardi Gras, we would go to people's houses along the parade route and have crawfish and lots of food. And this year it was very different because that part of the route was cut off. So we mostly survived on food bought from trucks, which wasn't the best, to be honest. And again, best energy, I think Muses. So let's see. Oh, a second question. Favorite non-carnival season parade. Does Super Sunday count? I think Super Sunday is right around St. Joseph's Day when the Mardi Gras Indians parade. It's the one time a year when Mardi Gras Indians are all on a known route and on the same route. So that's a great opportunity to see that part of our culture. It's not a traditional parade, but that would be my vote. We typically don't do out of season parades like St. Patrick's Day, mostly because St. Patrick's Day parades usually fall on a day that we host a large St. Joseph's Day gathering for my extended family. So we typically, and in a year like this one, St. Patrick's Day comes very soon after Mardi Gras, and frankly, we're a little paraded out. But Super Sunday, which also falls right at that same time, is my favorite, I think, non-carnival parade, using the word parade loosely. Chad Lancaster says, I'd also like to hear more about your book publishing process. Again, we're going to do a whole episode about that. So that's going to be coming up. I'm not sure, but certainly in the next two or three episodes, we'll do one, me and James Cullen, and just kind of talk about everything from the how the idea of the book got started to working through it and what it was like as a first-time author. So we'll do a whole episode, Chad, on that. Thanks for that question. Jeff Singer, what is a New Orleans place or event you will want you still want to experience for the first time? Jeff, this is a good question, and I had to think about this one for a while because the reality is I'm pretty lucky. I think we get out and do a lot. We did that before the podcast, but certainly with the podcast, I get out and experience New Orleans a lot, and I'm very thankful for that. But I was thinking about this. I want to experience French Quarter or Mardi Gras morning as an adult. When I was a teenager, I got to go in the French Quarter a little bit or Mardi Gras morning, but I really want to go and be able to take in the atmosphere, not Bourbon Street so much, but the atmosphere, the drag queen costume contest. And I also want to go to the Society of St. Anne parade, which is a really neat parade that starts in the Marigny and kind of goes through the French Quarter and goes to the river. And one of their traditions is that people carry the ashes of people who have died in the past year. And when they get to the river, they toss the ashes into the river. It's a really neat parade, walking parade with a lot of tradition. And I would really love to experience both those things. They're going to have to wait a couple more years until my kids are old enough that they want to go out and do things on their own without us on Mardi Gras morning. But I think that's it for me. Something I really want to do and just haven't gotten to do. Ellis Embolden asks, what's the history of the praline and its popularity as a New Orleans treat? So this is one that I don't think it's definitively known, but my understanding is that it probably, the sort of precursor to pralines probably came to New Orleans with the Ursuline nuns. Though it was a similar candy, it was made with almonds. It likely shifted to pecans because they were readily available in New Orleans as opposed to almonds. Much like Rose Nicot, early vendors of pralines were enslaved black women selling the candy on the streets of the French Quarter. And even today, most of the well-known praline shops are owned by women. In fact, we just lost the woman, Loretta, that owned Loretta's Pralines, just died in the last month. But most of the praline shops are female-owned to this day, which is sort of an interesting legacy. That also, by the way, when people ask me for things to do or things to do with kids, one of my favorite things to do is to go in the French Quarter and buy 3, 4, 5 different pralines from different shops and then go sit on the river and see the river traffic and kind of sample them and do a taste test. Really inexpensive, really fun thing to do. The adults can grab a cafe au lait. The kids love it, you know, getting to judge the different ones. And again, it's a couple dollars a piece. Neil Sellers, tips for bringing grandkids to Mardi Gras. I see so many stories of tarps, ladders, tents, and people guarding spots. Can we find somewhere that the little ones can enjoy the scene? So again, the first weekend of Mardi Gras is the best weekend for little kids, and usually the best spots are along Napoleon Avenue. It is a pain with people kind of staking out territory, and that seems to be getting worse, not better, unfortunately. But along Napoleon, particularly the further you get from St. Charles Avenue and the closer you get to the start of the route. Secondly, in a typical year, we would have a lot of parades start on Jefferson and Magazine, and Magazine Street is a really family-friendly area. It gets crowded, but not terribly so, particularly the first weekend. So any parades that would go down that route that weekend would be a good one. I've had Arthur Hardy on before, and that's where his Mardi Gras guide really comes in handy. It's worth getting and looking at the routes. Again, this year they really changed. Hopefully this is a one-year change and we go back to the expanded routes. I think One of the things that was really missing this year is that the parts that were cut off were, in many respects, the most family-friendly part. And it caused people to be compressed into a tighter space. And that definitely did cause problems with more people, more ladders, more tarps, all of that stuff. But when our kids were real little, we went, I can't remember if it's St. Stephen's or St. Michael's on Napoleon Avenue, just off of Magazine. So in the first couple blocks, we went and were able, in fact, pictures just popped up on our phone, memories of it. We were able to sit on the neutral ground or on the grass and just have space for them to enjoy it. And so that's it. I mean, that's my main tip. The other is you have to have a place to go to the bathroom. And so, as I've talked about in previous episodes, usually churches and schools either have free bathrooms or you kind of pay as you go. That's really important, particularly with young kids. But going to those areas is my number one tip. Let me see if I have any more questions that have popped up. All these questions, by the way, so far have been, we've been going for 40 minutes and they've all come from Patreon. So I certainly appreciate all of you that support me there. Let me see if there's any more Patreon. Lori Ostrico asked tips for first timers at Jazz Fest. I have a whole episode 9 called Happy Jazz Fest, which is all about sort of a Jazz Fest survival guide. I would take a listen to that. It still holds up. It's several years old, but the ins and outs of Jazz Fest don't really change that much. So if you listen to that episode, you'll get my complete rundown of how I do Jazz Fest and that sort of thing, Lori. Sean, what was your overall take of Carnival this season? What went well? What was your biggest challenge? Overall, I thought it was a good season. I thought it was just really nice to have Carnival back, to have Mardi Gras. I think that the weather went well. I don't think we had any rainouts. I think we had one day with a little bit of rain, so that was good. The weather kind of was up and down, slightly cool to very hot, but that's kind of typical in New Orleans. My biggest challenge, again, I think the cutting off of the routes really took away for us some of the things that we do. We have friends, again, along the route that are super generous and have nice parties and crawfish boils and all those sorts of things. And that was all taken away. And so that was a big, you know, we kind of just missed out on that and missed seeing friends and family in that way. And I think the challenge was that it did make it more crowded along St. Charles Avenue and Napoleon, without a doubt. At the same time, I think it was a successful carnival season. Melissa Walker asks several things. How's your back? So some of you may know I had back surgery 7 weeks ago. I'm doing okay, so thank you for that. How is the book release looking? Again, I mentioned that. Looks like May 1st, but we'll have a whole episode about that. Can a person bring food and beverages into Jazz Fest? So the short answer is no. You can bring water, and that is certainly one of my tips, getting back to Lori's question. You can bring a couple bottles of water each. It's good to freeze them or partially freeze them so that you have something cold and then let them melt in the heat of the day. You can get away with a little bit of food, particularly if you have kids with you or if you have some dietary issues, they'll let you bring a little bit. You're not going to be able to bring a picnic lunch in. James Redmond, when will Beyond Bourbon Street and Insider's Guide to New Orleans come out as an audiobook? So I'm not sure about the audiobook yet. There are no definitive plans or timelines yet for it. It's something I'm interested in doing. One of the challenges will be, how do you take a guidebook and make it an audiobook? It wouldn't be very interesting listen to me say, go to this restaurant and here's the address. So maybe there's a way to do it without the addresses and all of that stuff. So I'm not sure. It's something we're talking about, but we don't have an answer for yet. So those were all questions from Patreon supporters. So I really appreciate that. Let me jump now to Facebook questions. Nathan Norsworthy asks, can you explain what goes into being a crew member of a large parade, fees, parties, balls, throws, responsibilities, etc. So there's a pretty big range of parades and what goes into it. Some parades, member fees are a couple $100s. Some parades, it could be a couple $1,000s. And some parades charge a premium for certain floats. So for instance, Years ago, when Marie and I rode in Orpheus, there was a premium charge to ride on Leviathan, which is the Dragon, one of their signature floats. So there was an upcharge of a few hundred dollars if you wanted to ride on that float. So you have your basic fees. You are responsible for paying for buying all of your throws, and you can buy them through the organization or you can buy them independently. And then some organizations require you to buy some of their signature throws, no matter where you get your throws otherwise. So you can't throw, if you are in Muses, you can't throw iris labeled beads, for instance, or doubloons or any trinkets or anything like that. So you're going to buy throws from either a local vendor and or you're going to buy a package directly from your carnival organization or both. And it's a pretty big range, but people are spending on the low side $500 to $700, on the high side $2,000 to $3,000 for throws, depending on the parade. Some of the bigger crews, the routes are longer, something like Endymion, for instance. I know people that spend $3,000 on throws. They're also paying for member fees. Some have traditional balls, so there's expenses there. If you're a member of, say, Rex, you're going to go to the ball that night and you're going to wear tails, so there's an expense there. Some parades, like Endymion, have a coronation ball, so there's an expectation to go there. And again, there's a dress code, there's a fee there, tickets for that. If you are in Endymion or Orpheus, then by virtue of riding, you participate in the party. It's not really a ball, but the party afterwards, the extravaganza in the case of Endymion, or the Orpheuscapade in the case of Orpheus. Bacchus has something similar. But if you are going to bring other guests to that, then there's a cost to that. In addition, those types of events, there's usually a catering cost, so that when you get off the float captain usually coordinates that, but you have a table and you need to have food there. So, you know, the cost can go anywhere from a couple hundred dollars to several thousand dollars. And depending on which organization you join, they have more events or fewer events. So some of the parades essentially have a parade and an after party. And so those would be less expensive. And you're going to the after party, you know, dressed in your costume. And some of the bigger ones have everything from a formal ball to a coronation to a big party, as well as longer routes and, you know, probably spending more on throws and on the actual ride itself. So there really is something for everyone, but it really does run quite the gamut in cost. And again, I had this question randomly. Somebody asked me the other day, they were surprised that when you join an organization, that doesn't come with throws. So you are expected to buy your throws on your own, above and beyond any cost to actually ride. Kathleen Cole Anderson, what are your essential must-haves for Jazz Fest? So lots of Jazz Fest. Maybe we need to do a new Jazz Fest episode since there's so many questions. What should be in my bag when I head out? Again, I have a whole episode about that. A couple of things I'll say off the top of my head. Oh, and Casey Stone Garcia says, have him tell you what he lines his pockets with and why. So I'll do that. My general theory on Jazz Fest is pack as light as you can. We don't always follow this rule, but pack as light as you can. Bring a small backpack, bring water, sunscreen, a hat, a bandana, or something to cover your neck. I like to bring the cubes, which are the printed kind of grid of the music for the day, although you can get by with an app on your phone. It's good to bring a charger for your phone, a battery pack. It's also good to have some cash with you. There is an ATM on site, but there's always a ridiculously long line for it. So cash is good. It's also useful to have a couple of Ziploc bags to put your phone, anything important in it, in case it rains. But again, I go into a lot of detail in episode 9 about it. The question about what do I line my pockets with, I line my cargo pockets, and yes, I realize cargo shorts are outdated, but I line my cargo short pockets with foil. And the reason I do that is that I like to go buy meat pies, and I don't want to keep going back. So I buy a bunch of meat pies, and I put them in the foil-lined pockets so that they will stay warm. And I used to think that I was unique in this, and one day the vendor saw me doing it and she laughed and said, you would be surprised at how many people do exactly that. Or people bring Tupperware or Ziploc or something like that to try to, so that they don't have to keep going back. But I line my pockets with foil and I do it every year and my family laughs at me and I still continue to do it. So let's see. Isaiah Swift Hobbs asks, aside from the many traditions around Mardi Gras and the Rougerou, what are some other traditions, myths, etc., that resonate heavily in New Orleans that perhaps aren't shared elsewhere? So this one threw me because at first I thought, so you're saying, besides the thing that makes New Orleans most unique, what makes New Orleans unique? At least that's the way I took it. And so I think you can't throw out Mardi Gras. Mardi Gras is so integral to the city. And I believe that at my core that Mardi Gras is part of who we are. It is the friendliness. It is the fact that at Mardi Gras, you are standing on a corner with someone that you may never come into contact with any other time of the year for any other reason. But it's possible that you see those same people every year at that corner. And for that day, you take care of each other. You watch out for the kids. You share a box of fried chicken, maybe a beer. And it is a great equalizer in terms of you're in the street as a community enjoying a shared thing, something that we all love. So I think it's really hard to sort of say, well, besides that. Having said that, I think that second lines are a big thing that are, I think, completely unique to New Orleans. And second line season with Sunday second lines is a pretty amazing thing. Super Sunday with the Mardi Gras Indians is an amazing experience that I don't think there's anything like it. I think the tradition of the mummers in Philadelphia probably comes the closest to it, but it's still really pretty different. I don't know if Café au Lait, I guess you can get Café au Lait almost anywhere nowadays, but I think of that as a very New Orleans thing. And then the plethora of festivals, you know, so we've talked a lot about Jazz Fest, lots of questions because that's coming up. But the fact that we have so many just top-notch festivals almost all year long, you know, some get a lot of attention like Jazz Fest and Voodoo Festival and French Quarter Festival, but there are easily another 30 or 40 festivals that are just terrific with great food, world-class food, terrific music, great for families, almost every interest you can think of, and in many different parts of the city as well. And I think that that makes New Orleans unique. I've lived in a lot of places and, you know, there are events, but not the level of events that we have here and with the quality, again, of food and music. So those are a couple of things, I think, Isaiah. Donald Tatera says, tell me about camping options near New Orleans for something different to do. That's a question I've never gotten before, actually. So there's two that come to mind. One is on the West Bank in West Wego. You might remember not too long ago with Richard Campanella, I did an episode about the West Bank of New Orleans, and we talked about West Wego. So in West Wego, there's a place called Bayou Signet, and they have fishing both saltwater and freshwater because of where it is, which is sort of interesting. They have a wave pool, which is currently closed, but they have a wave pool. They have cabins and they have tent camping. The wave pool is closed right now, and I don't know if that's a COVID thing, but it's pretty cool when it's open. So that's something worth checking out. And then over across Lake Pontchartrain in St. Tammany Parish on the North Shore is Fountain Blue State Park. And again, they have tent and cabin camping, although their cabins are currently closed because they got a lot of damage in Hurricane Ida. So those are both. Bayou Signet from downtown is maybe 20 minutes away. And Fountain Blue State Park, again, from the French Quarter is maybe 45 minutes to an hour. So two different locations, kind of two different feels, both really nice state parks though, and definitely worth checking out. Mike Hogan, new to the crew after listening to the podcast for some time. It's fantastic. Thank you for doing them. Heading back to New Orleans in April after not having been there since December of 19, what's changed since the pandemic? How normal are things? What restrictions are still in place? So I think I mentioned this a little earlier. Couple businesses have closed. We've also had places damaged because of Hurricane Ida, like what I just mentioned. The biggest changes are the operating hours. So you really got to check ahead of time before you go any place, whether that's a museum or a shop or a restaurant or a bar. You got to really stop and call and see if they're open. Just as recently as last week, my wife and I were going to Hi Hat, which is a restaurant we like on Ferret, and we didn't call and they were closed. And it was like a Wednesday, I think, a day that I would have fully expected them to be open. And so you just got to check. That's the biggest thing. The mask mandate was just lifted. I'm recording this on March 8th, and it was just lifted the other day. Some places, I don't know if it's by requirement or not, are still asking for proof of vaccination. So it's good to have that with you. Other than that, I feel like things are getting back to normal. With the exception of this, lots of things are just not open or not open the hours you want. Sadly, we are losing places. So Seed, which is a really great vegan restaurant, is closing up. Cafe Amelie, which is a terrific restaurant in the French Quarter that opened just after Katrina, is closing. So it really is, which all of which made writing a travel guide very difficult because places were closing left and right as I was trying to write the book. But I think you'll find that things are starting to get back to whatever normal is. Again, proof of vaccine is what I would have, but the mask mandate is lifted. So I think, you know, probably wouldn't hurt to have a mask with you. But for the most part, in the last couple of days, as I've gone places, most of those signs have been taken down. It's mostly just the timing and the opening. Again, like the Backstreet Cultural Museum is such a great museum, and they're in a period of transition. So you got to check ahead of time and see when you come, are they open and where are they? That kind of thing. Julia McCurdy Gimble. It would be fun to know more about the life of an oyster shucker, the different preferences for tools, etc., how many they think they shuck in an average shift. So this one completely threw me. And I don't have any answers for you on this. I think this one might be worth an episode, actually. So I've put it on my list, Julia. I know that the guys at Felix's and Acme, particularly, must shuck hundreds of oysters in a shift. I know that they do customize their tools a little bit, often with the handles. They wear a special glove so that they don't get hurt while they're opening oysters. But a lot of them have tools that are quite old. That they've either handcrafted or that they've kind of adapted for themselves over the years. So that is definitely true. Let's see, you also said years ago, a shucker there at Felix's told us the trough on the floor was used for peeing. So no, that's not true. There's no way that you could have a business where that was happening. Those troughs underneath, I think, are mostly for the runoff of the water and the ice melting from the oysters. But this is a really interesting one. There was a business that I think might have closed now called Two Girls, One Shuck. They would be a really good interview. I need to see if they're still around. So I don't have this. I don't have a good answer for you on this one, Julia, but I'm going to add it to my list because I think it would be a fun one to explore. Sarah Floyd, well-seasoned versus mouth on fire. I'm going to paraphrase what she's written here, but basically she says, is it basically true that Louisiana and Cajun food can be seasoned well but full of flavor and not burn your mouth, or is the tradition essentially that it burns your mouth? So I think the general consensus is that food doesn't have to be super spicy, but we do expect it to be well flavored. And when I read your question, I thought about Old Bay seasoning in the Baltimore, Maryland area, and I'm going to aggravate some people from that area, but I'm not a fan of Old Bay at all, and I think that that's seasoned but not particularly spicy. I think for me, crawfish need to be spicy, but they don't need to be so hot that they burn your mouth. I think it's a little bit of a regional thing. In Cajun country out near Lafayette, the crawfish tend to be hotter, spicier. In New Orleans, they tend to be a little bit less spicy to me. You also mentioned shrimp, and shrimp tend to be more seasoned than spicy. I don't know why that is, other than just tradition, but you can certainly find crawfish that aren't going to sort of burn your lips off. Bevy Seafood does a great job. I mentioned earlier Bayou Beer Garden and Bayou Wine Garden. They bring in someone to do their crawfish. Their crawfish are really well seasoned, but I don't think of them as particularly hot. So I think it just kind of depends on who's doing them and what that person's preference is, to be honest. I think I've covered everything, but I want to make sure. Oh, okay. Last question from Barbara Taylor in the Facebook group. I would be interested to know what it's like to be a kid in New Orleans. Do your girls walk to school by themselves? At what age do kids start exploring the city on their own? And how do they begin to experience the city without their parents being around all the time? So I grew up in the city. I would say that it's different than when I grew up. I was a kid in the 70s. And by the time I was my children's age, I was riding my bike to our family restaurant, which was about a mile and a half away. I think that kids today, I don't know that sheltered is the right word, but are maybe watched over a little bit more. So certainly our kids don't quite have those freedoms. It was a lot of fun growing up in the city because of Mardi Gras. In our case, we owned a restaurant, and so that was kind of an interesting way to grow up. Our kids, we don't live close enough for the kids to walk, so the kids get driven to school. We are just to the point where we are starting to allow the kids to walk around the neighborhood a little bit. Some of that is that we live on a busy street. Some of that is just our own nervousness. I think New Orleans is a city that is great for families, but is also a city where you have to be very aware of your surroundings. And maybe that's just true in big cities today in general. And so we're just a little bit nervous as parents about that. I think we're probably a year or 2 years away from them wanting to go do some things with their friends at Mardi Gras. And that, you know, starts to look like letting your kids walk away from where you're standing at Mardi Gras and just go wander the streets before parades. That was very much, when I was a kid, sort of a first hints at independence, if you will. It's very much a sort of a scene while you're waiting for parades. Kids are walking up and down the streets and kids are tossing their footballs and that kind of stuff. So I can see that we are approaching, if not next year, the year after, the kids wanting to do some of that with their friends and maybe a little less time with mom and dad. But I think New Orleans is a really family-friendly place. And again, just to mention the book, again, this comes out in my book. People think of Bourbon Street, people think of drinking, and there's certainly plenty of that in the city, but it is a really family-friendly city. Most of the festivals are great for kids. You have Mardi Gras, of course. City Park is just a jewel of a park with so much to do in it. Riding a streetcar, no matter how old you are, never gets old. It's lots of fun. There really is a lot for kids to come and do. Some of the museums, the Children's Museum in City Park is really, really pretty neat. So it's a great place to grow up. You have snowballs, you have pralines, you have, you know, all this unique kind of candy and treats. Our kids look so much forward to Mardi Gras, and then they look forward to Halloween, which is a huge deal here in New Orleans. We're just over. In fact, I'm looking at a pile of beads as I'm talking to you now. So we're just getting over that, and they're already talking about Jazz Fest, you know, and they don't like the same parts of Jazz Fest that we like, but there's a kids area with live music and interactive displays and things like that. One of our kids is a big Foo Fighters fan, so she's looking forward to that. I think that it is underrated as a family-friendly city. The downside is that the schools aren't great. The public school system is sort of a mess. There are not a lot of great choices. Infrastructure in New Orleans is a challenge, I'm being generous. But it's a pretty fun place to grow up as a kid, and it's a pretty fun place to raise kids. Most of you that have listened a long time know that we made the decision to move from Northern Virginia back to New Orleans when our kids were 10 weeks old, and our kids are now 10 years old. So they've lived, you know, essentially their whole lives here. And our experience as parents has been almost all here. And while it's not always easy, it's really a lot of fun. And it's a lot of fun to see New Orleans through their eyes. So that's what I would say about that. That's a lot of questions, and we've been going for more than an hour, and now it's almost 6:30, so my family's going to be waking up. I really, really appreciate all the questions. I appreciate those of you that support me on Patreon. That makes such a difference. And also those of you in the Facebook group who shared questions, thank you. Once again, a plug for the book. If you can go, the thing you can most do to support me right now is to go pre-order a copy of the Beyond Bourbon Street Travel Guide. And again, I'll have links in the show notes, but you can do that at Amazon, at Barnes & Noble, at bookshop.org. And with that, I'm going to turn it over to the girls to take us away.
New episodes are available every other Wednesday. If you're enjoying the podcast, please share it with someone else who loves New Orleans as much as you do.
Until next time, laissez le bon temps rouler.
Thanks for listening to the Beyond Bourbon Street podcast. Find us anytime at beyondbourbonst.com.